Blog Talk Radio.
Find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future, and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you, and that ends somewhere beyond the limits of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great. Having a great week, getting a lot done. One of those busy weeks at work, you know, and that's okay. We were just talking about that before
the week,
show.
Yeah.
You know,
it
makes things
first
go quick.
Off, it's better than the alternative, right?
You know, that's right.
We wouldn't complain about having a job, and it gets you through the week. You know, when there's not much to do, the week kind of drags. When there's a lot to do, first thing you know, it's the weekend.
That's right.
And, of course, when you have a nice, good weekend going, first thing you know, it's Monday morning. And then, I don't
that's
know.
That's true.
First thing you know, you're 80, and life is all over.
But
it was fun.
When you're having fun. Yeah,
exactly.
You have fun along the way.
It was fun getting there. Well, any big stuff going on? Anything you want to share before we delve into our topic of the men who sold the moon?
I am currently getting through the Steve Jobs biography, and that may actually may influence how I do the show a little bit tonight. I'll bring him up from time to time, probably.
Are you going to call me
in preparation for the
big
Jobs movie this weekend? So,
oh, okay.
You know.
I thought maybe you were going to adopt his style and like call me a bozo sandwich or something like that.
You know, if I was to really adopt his style, he was incredibly rude. I mean, just incredibly. I mean, he would curse people out right and left and then just deliver this beautiful product as a result. I don't know how you get people to work for you when you're like that. You know, I guess it helps to be Steve Jobs, but, you know.
He got people to do amazing things for him, right? Not just work.
That's right.
But create the most unbelievable products for him,
That's right.
Interesting figure, guy who left us too young, that's for sure. Steve Jobs.
That's for sure.
See that, and which book is it? Who's the author of this one?
Oh, I think it's just called simply Jobs. Let me see if I'll pull it up here and give you the author and everything. But it's outstanding.
I'm gonna have to check that out. As we were discussing before the show started, I'm a little backlogged on my reading. I've got to get caught up on reading some things, but I don't know. Maybe by Christmas time I'll be ready to read the Steve Jobs book. So we've got a terrific show tonight. I'll tell you that what I'm excited about this week, what I'm excited about today, tonight, having prepared for this show, is the realization that, and this is how I came up with the name for tonight's show, the realization that we live in a Robert A. Heinlein novel. We are living.
Explain that.
In a book he would have written. Well, it's just, you know, I don't. Did you ever read The Man Who Sold the Moon?
Well, you know what? If I did, Phil, it's been. I think there's a possibility I read that book in in middle school. That's how long ago it would have been.
Okay, yeah, it's been a long time for me, and I didn't review the book. I just remember that it's about this extremely exuberant entrepreneur who decides he wants to buy the moon and who does incredible things to make the commercial exploitation of space really happen. He kind of pushes humanity into space through his desire to do to take ownership of the moon. And I think there's a real parallel between that kind of comical, fun science fiction figure from that book and the men we're going to be talking about tonight. Although they're deadly serious, and what they're making happen is big time serious. It's interesting that they're businessmen, they're entrepreneurs, they're, you know, movers and shakers in the business world, and they're people who are, I think, in a really good position to completely, to coin a phrase, transform the world, to really change just about everything about how we live. So I think that Robert A. Heinlein would totally approve of this. I think, you know, this he would see this as kind of a confirmation of his future history, that the events we see unfolding before us now are not unlike the kinds of things that used to occur in his books. And, of course, his books were great fun to read, so if we're going to be living in anybody's novels, right, you know, I mean, think about it. Isaac Asimov, yeah, they're good, important novels, but everybody just sits around and talks, right? And this is, I think we're much better off in a Heinlein book.
Well, it beats, you know, maybe James Bond or something, because, you know, these kind of characters in a James Bond novel would be the villain, right?
Exactly. Yes.
You know, and so I think there's a lot of people that have the idea that, you know, this much power concentrated in one individual is a bad thing. I suppose it could be. You know, power is one of those things that can certainly be exercised in bad ways. But I think that some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight are very positive. And so I'm excited about it. Yeah.
I think so, too. Well, and you know, we can start with you had sent me a link to a piece over on the Financial Times. And by the way, every article I refer to tonight is linked up at The Speculist. I'll go ahead and put that link in the chat room for anyone who's listening along. But I've got everything we're going to talk about tonight, I've got excerpts and links over at The Speculist. So it'll make it easy for you all to follow along with the subject matter as we go. But here this is in the chat room for everyone listening live. And if you're listening via podcast, just go to blog.speculus.com. Actually, you can go to speculus.com, follow the link to the blog, look for the thing about the men who sold the moon. Okay, there, having said all that, where was I? What was I about to say?
It all starts
with the piece on the Financial Times, which is the first one that you'll that you'll find in the Speculus piece, and it begins, you know, we'll begin very much on that note, because the author of this piece even called it technology vanity or visionary. And there's a passage kind of towards the end of it. Let me just read a little of this because I find this interesting. And you know, we're going to be talking about Elon Musk, Peter Diamandis, Jeff Bezos, and who am I forgetting? You know, the other one.
Sergey Brin.
Thank you, Sergey Brin. How could I forget him? We're going to be talking about them this evening. We're going to be talking about these incredible projects that they've undertaken, world-transforming projects. And that's what this piece in the Financial Times was about. And the author takes some time to say, is it right? Is this the correct approach, right? Stephen, to your point, should all this power be in the hands of just these private citizens? Should the ability to decide humanity's fate in some sense lie just with them? And he writes about this guy, Bill Janeway. He says, as the son of an angel investor who made his fortune during the Industrial Revolution, the younger Darwin was the beneficiary of a similar fount of personal patronage, says Bill Janeway, a veteran startup investor and economic historian. Yet, even if it has a long history, some argue that dependence on personal generosity may not be the best way to organize important scientific research. Such work is often better left to governments or established corporate research labs rather than individual benefactors. Mr. Janeway says, since there's a risk that ambitious individuals will brush aside established scientific disciplines such as peer review in the race for high-profile achievements. Others, however, argue that a breakout from the old forms of scientific research may be in order. In periods of very rapid technological change, the biggest opportunities often lie on the fringes of science research, where little work has been done before, making traditional approaches to peer review less useful, says Mr. Seeley Brown, a former head of Xerox's PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center. So there's the two views on this. And what I thought we would do is we're going to go through each of these guys, each of these big movers and shakers, these men who would sell the moon if they could, and talk about the plausibility of what they're proposing, how likely we think we are to actually see these things implemented, and we'll give a nod to that question for each one of them. Okay, we're not going to answer the question in general, maybe until the end, but we'll do it one by one as to, is this better to be happening with this one guy doing it, or would it be better if it was in some corporate lab, or would it be better if it was a government project? Okay, so we'll look at all of them from, we'll kind of triangulate around all those issues as we work through this, if that makes sense to you.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. So without any particular preference other than just the amount of hype that it's received, let's start by talking about Elon Musk and his Hyperloop. Proposed high-speed alternative to the rail line that's supposed to be developed between L.A. and San Francisco. Now, he says this Hummer can go 800 miles per hour and can get you from L.A. to San Francisco in 30 minutes. This is a really interesting story for any number of reasons. For one thing, we hear about these kinds of things all the time. We talked about the maglev train, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. And the first thing that you have to note about this is that this is not maglev.
No.
These are not vacuum tubes.
It's better.
It's not pneumatic. It's air cushioned. It's like, to me, I just keep thinking air hockey. Okay, that the
it's not a bad analogy.
Yeah, this train is sliding along in this tube like a puck on an air hockey table, and because it's being pushed up on a cushion of air, and the tunnel is not depressurized. It's partially depressurized. So it's like you take some of the air out, so you get that speed boost, but you don't have to worry about this, you know, all the catastrophes that can occur if you're trying to maintain a completely vacuum sealed tube. If it's partially depressurized and then air gets in, it's like, oh darn, we have to depressurize it again. But it's not the same level of catastrophic risk that accompanies a purely pneumatic tube system, which is what the maglev, in theory, that people talk about would require. So it's
there's other advantages too. One is that you could travel, 800 miles an hour, and still not break the sound barrier, which is pretty interesting because you break the sound barrier at much lower speeds in an airplane. So what gives there? It's the lower pressure, and also the air within the tube that's left would be in motion as well. So relative to the air that's in the tube, you're not breaking the sound barrier, and because of the lower pressure and also the temperature, I believe, as well, they're going to keep the temperature in such a way that it won't break the sound barrier. So no sonic booms, but traveling at incredible speeds, and just a neat idea. It's a very neat idea.
And here's what's great about this. So Elon Musk publishes this thing as kind of an open source thing. All right, he puts together the basic research and says, here, we could do this. Now,
somebody
take this and go do it. And the news breaks out all over the place. Elon Musk wants to build this train, and then he has to come back and say, no, I didn't say I was going to build it. I just said it would be a pretty good idea, to the point where he's thought about it and said, okay, yeah, I'll do it. All right, you know what? Everyone's associated my name with it. You know, I'm a little bit busy with SpaceX and Tesla. And, trying to get humanity to Mars. But what the hell? I'm going to build a train for, high-speed Hyperloop from L.A. to San Francisco and back.
Here's my thought, Phil. You know, why didn't he just go ahead and build a flying suit of armor and be done with it? You know, I mean, he's Tony Stark, you know. the guy's incredible. You know, this is exactly why billionaires are awesome. They have dreams like the rest of us, And, you know, they have human foibles just like the rest of us, too. And,
yep.
You know, we're not talking about gods here. We're talking about guys that just have a whole lot of money. But the reason they have a whole lot of money is because they just don't take no for an answer in things. They,
right.
You know, they take a big dream, like the dreams that pass through the minds of everybody, but they don't let it go, and they just hang on to it and they work it, and sometimes they get lucky and they get rich, and then once they get rich, watch out, they, you know, the dreams get bigger, I think. So
that kind of goes to the question of, is it better that this be done by an individual with a lot of money, or is it better that this be done by a government agency, or would it be better if it was done by some big corporate lab? You know what, I'm going to take that last one, and I'm going to say, that was an option back in the 60s, maybe. I'm not sure that big corporate lab exists anymore. What's the big company
Do we even have a Bell Lab anymore?
We don't. They've been so scaled down and scaled back. Those organizations don't exist. I mean, and we'll be talking about Google in a minute and the big things they're doing. So some of these are, you know, the big crazy billionaires and their big companies that they own. But, yeah, but the idea that you're going to have, you know, General Dynamic or Lockheed or somebody like that build something, you know, I mean, they don't
A lot of this stuff is just so crazy that it just wouldn't work, with stockholders. You know, they expect, more down-to-earth goals. You know, that they don't want blue sky, experimentation with their money. You know, that's – and so you pretty much – And so I suppose you could do it with a government project, but, our government doesn't have all the money in the world anymore either. So I think sometimes it comes down to if we're going to do it at all, and especially a proof of concept project like what this would be, I think it's kind of down to these guys. What do you think, Phil? I mean, to some extent, some of these things just have to be done by these people, or it's not going to be done at all.
The point is, the government's already trying to build a high-speed rail line between L.A. and San Francisco. They're using a different model, and this is what he's proposed an alternative to. So, may the better train win. This one certainly sounds a lot more exciting than the one the government, the state of California, is putting together. And
at probably 10 times the cost.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, that's the big problem with, I think, the traditional government program around something like that is just all around time frames and how big we expect budgets to be. It's why, you know, we're going to talk about all this great space stuff tonight, and we won't talk about anything NASA is doing. Right, we've got this government agency that used to send us to the moon and has sent us to Mars several times, at least through really cool probes, but is no longer, I think, on the cutting edge of getting us into space or getting humanity into space. Maybe just because of a change in how government functions. But bottom line is, the government had a shot and they didn't want to do anything remotely like this. So if you want this done, I think Elon Musk is your guy, right? He's the guy to make this happen. And one thing I wanted to point out that I don't think I mentioned earlier, and I think it's crucial to this, is the reason he's doing reduced pressure rather than vacuum tube, the reason he's doing air-lifted rather than maglev, you know, why is he doing this, like, scaled-down version instead of the super high-tech version that we've all been reading about for years? Do you know why?
Cost, I imagine.
No, it's because this stuff already exists. Everything.
We don't have to invent anything to do this, right? It's just
everything he wants to put into this already exists. It's just a matter of applying technology that people have already invented, as distinct from maglev, where you'd have to invent a whole lot of stuff to make it happen. And I'm not down on that kind of project, but I mean that just goes to show you this is this isn't like sending a man to the moon back in the 60s, right? This is just like, okay, well, we have all the stuff. We can assemble it this way if we decide we want to.
Practically off the shelf, you know. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to watch that one happen. Feasibility, what do you think, Stephen? You think there will be an 800-mile-per-hour train running between L.A. and San Francisco in our lifetimes built on the model?
That's two different questions, isn't it? I think feasibility is, yes, it's very feasible. Second question, will we actually see it? Well, you know, it comes down to Elon Musk. How committed to the project is he? Will he get sidetracked with Tesla or SpaceX? We will see. But, you know, he has tended to, you know, think how people would think of SpaceX maybe 10 years ago. You know, it's just a pie in the sky mm-hmm. by a rich guy, right?
Yep.
Well, it's a going concern now, and you know, the only private company to put a capsule in orbit and bring it home to dock with the space station, and this week, Phil, they flew their Grasshopper rocket again, and that thing is cool. I know you've seen it, where it just takes off and then bring it back down and land it on the same pad, all rocket controlled. That's amazing. This particular flight was kind of cool because they did some lateral maneuvering. They took it up, moved to the right, depending on how you're looking at it, but moved it to the side about 100 yards, and then brought it right back, centered over the pad, and then landed it. Just showing that, you know, we can maneuver this thing all around. Very, very cool.
And very cool, very exciting stuff. You know, they're going to be the company that, well, we'll talk about Blue Horizon towards the end of the show. But you know, if anyone seems to be poised to be the people who truly get us into space, it seems like SpaceX has got us well on our way, and they're really putting the technology in place to make amazing things happen. And that's what leads us to our second big project that Elon Musk has going on, which is he wants to get us to Mars. So we know that. We know that SpaceX has the Falcon 1, the Falcon 9, the Falcon Heavy. They're working on the Dragon, which is their replacement for the space shuttle, the thing that can take 7 astronauts into space. And this is all well and good, right? Says Elon Musk, but it's not the end game, all right? And I got a quote here from him. I just think this is the coolest thing. He says, "The key thing for me is to develop the technology to transport large numbers of people and cargo to Mars. That's the ultimate awesome thing."
Yeah,
and
he has publicly said that he intends to retire on Mars, and founding a colony on Mars, and you know, be the founding citizen, retire there and die and be buried on Mars.
Yes,
that is
he wants
pretty
to
cool.
put 80,000 people on Mars. He wants to create a true human colony on the planet Mars. And I laugh not because I think the idea is funny, but because I think the idea is absolutely wonderful and awesome. When he says it's awesome, he's absolutely right. And he says, but you know what? I got to pay the bills along the way, so I'm running SpaceX to put up GPS satellites, you know, to do science experiments, you know, taking NASA's money, taking the money of people who need to put up broadcast satellites, whatever. You know, we'll make these little baby steps into space commercially viable, so that we can do the big dream, which is, that I'm gonna live on Mars. And I think going back to what you said at the beginning, Stephen, there it is, right? We all got dreams. Everybody dreams of living on Mars. But here's a guy actually trying to make it happen, you know, not only for himself, but for
79,000 of his closest friends.
Exactly. 79,000 of the rest of us.
Those are 999.
And when I say trying to make it happen, I don't just mean in a crazy way.
Yeah.
If anybody's got a shot at making this happen, I'd say it's Elon Musk, right? So it's truly impressive what he's doing. And it takes us back to the and I don't know if you saw this, but they put out a press release a while back. There's no short-term plans to IPO SpaceX. He said, not until we get to Mars, then we'll IPO.
There you go.
I just think that's the greatest thing ever, you know. It's like, okay, we'll get to Mars. And then we'll have our IPO.
I think it'd be good to get the inside track on that IPO. I don't know. You know, he might. In order to get the inside track, you might have to be one of the people that go to Mars. You know, he
right.
would respect you, and that way you can be one of the original people to jump in on that early. But anyway, that is very cool dream, and we are going to run out of time, Phil, if we don't move on.
Yeah, well, just very quickly, once again, for this one, I think it's the same set of criteria. And basically, you come down to, I don't know anybody could do this but Elon Musk. If the government wanted to send us to Mars, they've had decades and decades to send us to Mars and haven't even tried. So,
and it's a big planet. If they want to do it, they can do it too. But at this point, if I were a betting man, I would bet on Elon over any government.
What do you think? You think he'll do it? You think it'll happen?
Yeah, I think he will. I think he will take. I don't know if he will live to see a colony of the size he's talking about on Mars, but I think he will put people on Mars.
Absolutely,
it's
all
doable.
It is doable.
It's right on the edge of doable, but it's doable.
I think it is too, I'm betting on Elon. Okay. Here we go. Next, we're gonna go from the sublime, if not to the ridiculous, then to the yuck-inducing, because now we're going to talk about Sergey Brin. Not that there's anything yuck-inducing about him. He's a great guy, co-founder of Google. But his project, which we were going to talk about this last week, he's a big supporter of vat meat, which we've talked about, the idea of growing
many
meat
times
in vitro from stem cells. I'm sorry?
Well, yeah, we've mentioned this several times, and you know, there's some fun things you can talk about when you talk about vat meat, and there, you know, the controversy among vegans is, well, can a vegan eat this? I think more significant is, will meat eaters eat this? And because vegans represent about 1% of the population, the rest of us eat meat, and the question is, will we eat this stuff? I would say, as long as it's gross, no. But I think this is vat meat version 1.0. And what do you spend on creating this? It seems like it was in the neighborhood of this particular project. How many millions did he spend on this, Phil?
I don't know. I haven't read that.
Somewhere in the story. But anyway, he spent a lot. And word is it. Looks like a burger, it smells like a burger, and tastes almost like a burger. almost as good as a burger. So what we need, Phil, if it's a $1 million burger, we need how many orders of magnitude to make this thing competitive with the Whopper, you know? About 7 orders of magnitude will bring it on down to the $1 Whopper. And at the same time, these things, as the price drops on these things, if we see something similar to the price drop of computers, it will get better too. And so I'm very hopeful. I eat meat all the time, but you know what? If I'm offered something that tastes as good and is better for the environment and doesn't require animal suffering, then I'm on board, man. And you know what? We can also make it more nutritious for us too. We can, instead of loading ourselves down with omega-6 fatty acids, we can create meat that would be better for our bodies at the same time. So
that's right. We can make it the equivalent of grass-fed, which is one of the alternative. You know, the meat market as it is, the consumer market for meat, is a fairly complicated thing. People buy organic, right? They pay more for that because they think it's better for them. Or they'll buy grass-fed because they think it's more humane to raise cattle that way, and also because nutritionally they think
it's probably better for them. Yeah.
So there's already kind of these specialty choices that, there's things like kosher and halal. There's all these, like, based on my personal beliefs or what I think is good for me, I will pay additional in my meat purchase. Well, this is, I think, will show up as another category of that, right? Initially, it'll be, okay, well, this isn't everybody's cup of tea, right? This isn't everybody's burger and fries, but some people, you know, some real heroic types will do it. Okay, I'm going to make the sacrifice. I'm going to eat this kind of meat because it's better for the planet or whatever, and it costs me more, but that's okay. I'm going to do it. And then eventually you get parity, right? Eventually it gets better and better and better. And to your point, Stephen, it's the same thing as what you would have gotten from a feedlot. It's the same thing that you would have gotten from a butcher shop. And then that's the meat hilarity, right, at that point.
exactly.
vat meat takes over at that point, and we probably move very rapidly away at that point from killing animals for food. I think that that whole industry probably gets subsumed by in vitro meat at that point. And who knows how long that will be from now, but I don't think it'll be terribly long. You made your point about how many orders of magnitude. If Ray Kurzweil were here, he'd tell us how fast things were doubling, right? He would.
Right. Well, if it's seven orders of magnitude and they do it every 2 years, then we're talking in 14 years, right? In 14
yeah.
years, we move from the million-dollar vat meat burger that's somewhat close to a burger to something that tastes awesome. They cost a buck, you know, and no animal had to die in the making of it. So,
right. And if it happens, if it takes even twice as long as that, it's happening wicked fast.
That's exactly
right.
Something
as ingrained as meat eating. So I think we can both agree this is one that I believe this is humanity's future. This is how the idea of eating meat will continue into the future.
And I think that our future children will look back on us and think of us as,
pretty gross.
They kill the animals for food. That's terrible.
Yeah.
That's okay. They can look down on us because it's a brighter future, if you ask me. And
that's right.
It's better for the environment, better for us. It's just better all around. Yep. Looking forward
to
that.
Absolutely. Okay, so there's that one. Should the government be doing this? Why is Sergey Brin doing this? You know, this one feels like one that, yeah.
Yeah, it's FDA written all over it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why aren't they doing this?
Maybe they'll get on board here. Maybe they'll be inspired by what Sergey's doing. He founded Google. He's going to save a lot of cows' lives. Although we've talked about this, he's also going to save a lot of cows from ever existing.
There's the question. Would you rather be a cow that doesn't exist at all or a cow that gets slaughtered at some point? Who knows? animal suffering is a bad thing, though.
The question of whether you'd rather or not be a cow that doesn't exist is too philosophical a question for this show tonight. We'd need a 90-minute show, I think, to really get into that. I want to go back now and listen to all 100 isms and see if there's one that applies to that cow that doesn't exist. Okay. Next, another one that might be a good candidate for the government to do, self-driving cars. And we're giving Sergey Brin full credit for this, even though it's actually his company, Google, that's doing it. And we don't need to spend a lot of time on this one because we've talked about it so many times over the past couple of years on this program. This is another one that I think you can just pretty well count as a done deal. I think there is going to be some pain. There's going to be some legal battles along the way. But ultimately, the technology is going to be too good not to use. And we're going to live in a world where
better than us pretty quick because I think it turns out that just people are not that great of drivers. We think because there's nothing to compare us to, but I think pretty quickly it'll
be
shown that
is that your professional opinion as a personal injury attorney, right?
I would you wouldn't believe the type of accidents that I see in my business.
Yeah.
People do stupid stuff, behind the wheel of a car. They text, they drink, they drive angry. They're fighting with their literally fist fighting with the person in the seat next to them. I've seen that.
Right.
I see that a lot.
Right.
I say a lot. I would say I see that about once a year. Someone's literally in a fist fight going down the road. What else? I mean, just any kind of craziness you can imagine. Mothers that are turning completely around, dealing with the kids in the back seat, putting on makeup, everything. People get distracted going down the road, and then bad things happen. And so, if a machine can do that so much better, a machine never blinks. A machine can have eyeballs looking in all directions at the same time. It never gets bored or tired or whatever. It never gets angry. It just does its job. And we will adopt this. We will probably move real quickly from somewhere in the neighborhood of about 45,000 deaths per year on the highway. I think that can be slashed in half pretty quickly, then maybe slashed in half again and again. And I, for one, can't wait to see it happen. I'll be out of a job, but so will a lot of emergency room people and insurance company folks. We'll just have to find something else to do, but a Holocaust will be averted. It's a Holocaust that we're used to, 50,000 people a year.
50,000 people die every year from this.
Yeah. It's basically a Vietnam. The number of soldiers
Vietnam
who died in
every
all 14
year,
years of the Vietnam War die every single year, and it's not just soldiers that are prepared for it. We're talking about children, women.
People who are just minding their own business driving. Well, Michael Sargent, for heaven's sakes, right? I mean,
our good friend Michael Sargent,
co-host
on the show, not with us any longer. It's something that can be done with. You know, it can be improved on, and so can't wait for it. It's going to be great.
Absolutely. Well, it absolutely is, I think we agree that this one will show up. Would be a good one for the government to have taken on. They just never did. But we'll be dealing with them as it becomes the model. That's for sure.
To the credit of the government, they sort of got this kicked off, Phil. If you remember the DARPA Grand Challenge, you know, the blue sky folks at the Defense Department, DARPA. They had their grand challenge, and that was really the beginning of all this. And of course, Google got involved in a major way in some of those grand challenges, and now they're pushing this hard. So yeah,
very cool. All right, so what's next, Stephen? What's our next?
The next is Peter Diamantis and asteroid mining. I almost stole thunder from this one just a second ago by mentioning it along with SpaceX. One of the ways that Diamantis' group intends to get into space is through SpaceX. So, I mean, he'll be catching rides on SpaceX and rockets, and then putting things out into the solar system. Things like telescopes to find asteroids. And then after they're found and identified, and they can tell a lot about the makeup and the composition of these asteroids, decide which ones deserve their attention, and then send out little robot probes to go get them and to mine these asteroids. Apparently, there's an incredible amount of wealth in these asteroids, and not just wealth that we'll bring back to Earth, but it's wealth that's pre-positioned within the solar system, which will make it. You know, you could, for example, if you were able to get a hunk of ice, maybe from an asteroid or a comet, and position it in a Lagrange point, that would be a great place to have some water, oxygen, and hydrogen for maybe a pit stop on the way to Mars. That could be where where Elon Musk stops and gets a drink of water on the way to Mars. So,
You get the water that you take to Mars, since you're going to need some water
exactly.
when you get there, right? Yeah,
that's right.
A lot of these techniques that will be developed and that are going to make huge fortunes for somebody, probably, hopefully, a good number of people in the coming decades. The technology that's developed, the techniques that are developed, will be completely applicable to Elon Musk's plan to go to Mars or anybody else's plan to go anywhere else, right? This is the true beginning of us venturing into space in a serious way. It's the commercial development of space, and it's also the use, I don't want to say exploitation, but I can't think of a better word. That's what it is. It's the actual getting into space and doing something there. We're not living there yet because these are robotic probes that are going out and finding all the stuff, but it's the next step before living there, and I think it's the thing that will make living there possible. One of the things he says there's 9,000 of these near-Earth asteroids. So you think of asteroids, mining the asteroids. You know, when I was a kid, that would have meant, because science fiction stories would have been, well, you go out to the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, where all the asteroids are. He's like, no, he's just talking about stuff that's here somewhere in the vicinity of the
in our neighborhood,
Earth. So somewhere right around here, there's 9,000 of them, and we're finding about 1,000 more every year. So this is a huge.
And what's cool about these is it's actually, although they're further away than our moon often and usually, it's an easier trip to go to these near Earth asteroids and come back. Now, maybe not easier if you were going to take people. But because you'd have to take sufficient food, oxygen, and all that if you're going to take people.
Right.
So that's, but it's an easy trip for, for like a probe or something because there's, there won't be any gravity well to climb out
of. You only
got
the one gravity well.
On the return trip.
On Earth.
Once you get into space and get past low Earth orbit, it's just a gentle push and you get to wherever you want to go. And so it won't be too hard to get to these things. And I've heard them, you know, describe this as simply, you know, the world's first trillionaire will be, you know, some of these asteroid mining guys, and I hope that's true. I hope that's what, you know, there's that much wealth to be had, and if there is, then well, it will be a real gold rush, and that will be the thing that takes people off the planet. And I'm glad.
You know, this looks to be as big as the gold rush or the oil boom or any of those ever were, but it's that combined with the discovery of the new world, right? It's like both of those. When you combine both of those ideas, first the idea of opening up the new frontier, which is always exciting anyway, and then the idea of there's vast wealth there, which I guess was probably a big appeal to the new frontier anyway. Come to think of it, that's one of the reasons that people first started sailing across the Atlantic to get here, right? They were hoping to find hordes of gold and those kinds of things. But this stuff we know is there. The resources that have already been identified are enough to make it worth going economically. You can look at, I mean, what is it? Diamandis says at one point, he says, some of these asteroids are worth trillions of dollars in assets. Will it happen? Absolutely. The thing is, you know, you don't leave money sitting on the table, and you don't leave money floating around out there in space. If there's a market for this stuff, and the technology is emerging that's going to enable it, this one is a done deal. This will happen. You know, either the world ends or we start mining the asteroids. But just put it that way. Right?
Yeah. Let me just throw this out as an idea, Phil. What if there was an asteroid that was the right shape and size to be put into sort of a permanent trajectory of, you know, sort of an orbit going back and forth from Mars to Earth, sort of in an ellipse, and it was hollowed out and made into a ship. You could have something much bigger than we could afford to actually build. You know, you could have it fashioned by robots, and then you just take people to this thing, and it could be the bus, kind of a permanent bus that takes things back and forth from Mars to Earth. I'm just throwing that out. What do you think?
That's a great idea, like a huge cruise ship, right?
Yeah, the bigger the better, because you know, you need space for food, and the, you know, we don't need to do Mars like an Apollo program. You don't need to stuff people into a tiny little capsule. You're talking a long trip. And,
it's going to be
a long trip,
well, especially if we do it the way you just said, right? Because that's going to be at least once around the sun to get to Mars. And plus, there's going to be the trip to the asteroid, and then the trip from the asteroid to Mars. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it needs to be comfortable.
And you can adjust to being in space. I mean, it's really a good idea on a lot of fronts. And the best part is, once you've got it going, it's just permanent. And then you get like six or seven of them going, right? You got kind of a line. It's like a cruise line attaching Earth and Mars. Great idea, Stephen. Let's do some back of the envelope trigonometry real quick and see how long that orbit would have.
Yeah, that's great.
Anyone listening along, feel free to work with the calculations.
I'm open to investors right now. So you know.
Keep in mind, it was Stephen's idea, though. So you know, but we do appreciate you doing the math for us on that. But isn't it appropriate that Peter Diamandis would be the guy pushing this idea, and that he's the guy who wrote the book Abundance? Because this is truly
best book of the year, by the way, last year. It was, I thought it was, if you haven't read Abundance, go get it right now. It's a great book.
It's one of my all-time favorite books. It's right up there with, you know, there's a short list of books that I think everybody should read. And in fact, we're going to talk at some point. I think every high school student should read that book. I think they should read that. They should read The Rational Optimist.
Singularity is Near.
The Singularity is Near. It's getting better all the time. And maybe Ramez Nam's new book, The Infinite Resource, right? Or is that what it's called? I think so. Which is about ideas. But these books that give us a positive view of the future that kind of counter what we typically hear about the world. I think that worldview is, it's important for people like us, but it's really important for young people to get their head around those kinds of ideas. And we really need to see some of them, the people who are going to be going to Mars, right? the ones who won't just be retirees going to settle on Mars, but who are going to go there and have their careers there and live there. The people who are going to be heavily involved in mining the asteroids or the self-driving car business or any of the rest of these things. This worldview needs to arrive to them, needs to be delivered to them, and I don't think our current educational infrastructure is probably taking that to them. But I digress. That's another show. We'll talk about it another night. All that's to say, Peter Diamandis wrote Abundance, and here he's talking about the ultimate post-scarcity scenario, right? Even if you have machines that'll generate anything you want on Earth, there's always some buzzkill who's going to say, yeah, but what if we run out of stuff for the machines to make things out of? It's like, you know what? Don't worry, we got it. There's 9,000 of these rocks just in our basic neighborhood. They've got more stuff than you can possibly imagine. We're finding 1,000 more every year. Once we get at those, we got the whole rest of the solar system to take advantage of. Once we get good at that, we got the whole rest of the universe to take advantage of. It's really a first step into kind of almost unlimited resource thinking, beyond any limits we've ever encountered before.
Awesome. Awesome. I think we'll see big things out of Planetary Resources, that company. I think within the next decade, they'll begin to get out there and actually start making money with that. So very cool. Very cool.
It's going to be extremely exciting stuff. Well, the next person on our list is Jeff Bezos of Amazon, and he's also into private space development, but that's about all you can say. We know that Blue Origin exists. We know that they've launched a few spacecraft, but here's the guy who is much like a character from a novel, right? Because he's as big as any of the rest of these guys in terms of, checkbook, right? I mean, he's a billionaire too, right? Founder of Amazon, for heaven's sake. But he's kind of mysterious about it. SpaceX, they do the press releases, they do the big announcements. Well, Blue Origin, they did a few little videos like 6-7 years ago, but we haven't heard much of anything about them. Have they stopped, or are we going to hear something just huge and earth-shaking from these guys at some point? What do you think?
I don't know. I think that they're going to be hard-pressed to keep up with Elon Musk. The amount of just the sheer number of rockets that are being produced for SpaceX, and just how much real work is being done for that company. I don't know if anybody can really catch up in the near term. I just haven't heard too much out of these folks. So
yeah, unless they're gonna introduce a completely different model, which is possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Y'all come down to Columbia because we have a space elevator. That would be great.
Well, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Barring something really bizarre like that, I don't see them catching up anytime soon. Maybe Blue Origin could get in the space mining business, the asteroid mining business, and be a competitor of Planetary Resources. Maybe that's in their future, but just as far as launch capability, the guys to beat right now are SpaceX.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, they're the ones putting together the big rockets and the big craft that can carry people. They're like the mini NASA, right? And even applying the term mini is kind of diminutive and unfair. They're like the new NASA, the new privatized NASA. Giving us all the stuff that
they're ones with capsules that have the new car smell.
Exactly right. You put that green air freshener, pine tree air freshener there in the new the Dragon capsule. But I'm holding out for Jeff Bezos is he's the mysterious guy working behind the scenes, and then boom, some huge announcement, and or they team up, right? He and Elon Musk team up and do something remarkable together. But one of the cool things about these various space scenarios is how well they work together. And you had already made the point, which I had planned to come to eventually, which is how well Planetary Resources, what they're doing, will support what Elon Musk wants to do in terms of going to Mars, and how well he's doing with SpaceX supports getting the technology infrastructure they need to get their thing going. You know, there's an awful lot of reciprocal give and take back and forth here. And even as the artificial intelligence of self-driving cars enters our workforce, enters our economy in so many other ways, and threatens us with creative destruction of the catastrophic success variety, we see that same group of people and we see that same technology being applied to ways that open up, as I said before, virtually unlimited resources for humanity. So it's a really exciting time. I mean, we face a lot of challenges going into the future. You know, and we've talked a lot about, you know, what's going to happen with the economy. But one thing that has got to make you feel good about the what potentially can happen with the economy is to see this new frontier opened up, to see the possibility that we might have another place, another planet that we live on as a species, that that we might have all these new resources that will be that we'll be taking advantage of, that we have a new place to go, a new adventure for us to have. And it kind of makes that whole, well, I don't know what economic system from the 19th or 18th or 17th century is going to be exactly the right one for 10 years from now or 50 years from now or 100 years from now. But I don't necessarily have to know the answer to that question to know that this stuff is, like, really cool and really exciting. And there's just an awful lot to look forward to. These guys are what I love being about a futurist, you know? They really are. These guys make me happy.
Yeah, there's, you know, if this one aspect of the future doesn't excite you, well, just wait. I've got more, you know. You know, if this doesn't excite you, we can talk about other things, because there's too much to talk about. Well, interesting thing, in reading about planetary resources and what they want to do, their model is so much different from the way the government does it. And here's one way, and this may be why we're not seeing the government taking the lead like they used to, and we're seeing these other groups come forward. You know, the government, when they want to put up a space telescope, they spend $1 billion or, you know, multi-billion dollars, and it's all clean room technology, and, you know, in order to even get near it, you have to, you know, have gone through the decontamination process to get in this clean room and even work on the space telescope, and then they carefully load into the rocket. You know, what they're talking about with the telescopes they're going to use planetary resources, they're talking, you know, these are the sort of things, you know, I've got five laying on my desk, you know, these guys are, they're engineering them in such a way that they're robust, you know, if there's a problem with one of the telescopes, they can, they got five more right next to it. You know, they don't send out one telescope, they send out dozens, and so, you know, it's robust. It's they've got redundancy built in, and it's dirt cheap. You know, they can for $1 million they can put up 1,000 of them. You know, it's crazy cheap, and they're doing it. You know, and that's the model to do it by. You know, if your object is to make money, you need to be smart about things like that, and they are. That's what they're doing. So
absolutely. Hey, great question from Ken in the chat room. He says, how does the ore get to the ground? How does it get back to Earth in the planetary?
To some extent, I think that it can be brought back home in a SpaceX capsule. Like SpaceX can bring things home in their capsules now, but to some extent, it's gold is even more valuable already in space, because you don't have to launch it into space. Gold is an incredibly useful metal to do all kinds of cool things with, and the fact that it's already in space makes it more valuable than the gold sitting on the planet. And so I think to a great extent, a lot of this will
never be brought
home.
As long as you can refine it and turn it into what you want to do, right? Which requires manufacturing infrastructure in space. That's interesting. To take advantage of the value, we'll have to have more things going on in space. Interesting. Which
will
create more need for more things to be in space. It's really kind of a bootstrapping our way into space by mining these asteroids.
It's the only way to do it, Phil. We can't government program our way into space. You know, we spent in today's dollars billions. And how many guys did we put on the moon? What, 12, 13? You know, it was not that many, okay? And
hang on.
Yeah, how many guys actually walked on the moon?
12 guys.
Yeah, right. 12 guys. Okay.
Yeah.
A dozen guys and spent billions to do it. That's just not the way to do space. We got to figure out ways to make money doing these things. And there are some money making ventures in space. Telecommunications satellites, things like that. But we ought to be able to do more. And that's what these guys are doing. And I think it's just a matter of time. And if it's not going to be these rich guys doing it, I don't know who would. The government can't do it because just the way that they do it is just too expensive. And then publicly held corporations, I don't see them doing it because they have to answer to stockholders who want to see what the bottom line is going to be like this quarter and not in 10 years. So it needs to be either very small, closely held private companies or just billionaires that are crazy enough to try. I think that's what...
Yeah, I think that there was a time when the government could do it. Maybe not the whole thing, but, you know, if you look at, to make a very strange analogy here, the Apollo program, which we were just referring to, is kind of the million-dollar hamburger of space travel.
Yeah,
right?
You
know, it's the thing that shows you can do it, and then from there you've got to get it incrementally cheaper and those kinds of things. These days, NASA wouldn't even be able to do something like that, unfortunately. I really don't think they're set up, I don't think that our government is set up in such a way that we could make a project like that happen through the government currently. But it is possible to do something like that with government, as Apollo demonstrates, right? And there was a time when the private sector and the public sector were both doing really huge, cool things. You know, you'd get like the Empire State Building built by the private sector. You get like the Hoover Dam built by the public sector. Everybody was, you know, showing off what amazing, incredible things they could do, and often in short periods of time, things that had never been done before. But right now, if that capability belongs to anyone, if it's resting in any hands, it's in the hands of people like these guys. They're the ones who have the resources to do it, that aren't constrained by vast bureaucracies and needing to please everyone. And you know, Stephen, to your point earlier, you know, having to check off endless checklists that you've got an office of people just coming up with more checklists that you have to check off. These are the people who can really truly make these things happen. And if these things are going to happen, and I don't see an item on this list that I would actually bet against, it's going to be because these individual people had a vision, had the resources to do it, and made it happen. And I think that's a very exciting thing. Oh, gosh, it's getting late. What's our music?
Our music tonight is Dog Days by Locomotive Ghost.
Dog Days by Locomotive Ghost. So this time the music is not thematically related, apparently.
Apparently not.
Okay,
it's a great sounding song. I hope you enjoy it.
All right. Well, thanks for putting that together. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. We will be back again next week, I think, on Wednesday night. We were supposed to be on Wednesday this week. Appreciate you hanging with us on a Thursday evening. But we'll be back again with an all-new show next week. And until next time, live to see it.
Everybody seems to have that acquisitive eye. Working their jobs, collecting their pay. Meanwhile, the world outside is quickly passing them by. Solstice approaches, so let's make the most. Left us behind.
last forever.